Your hands were made for greatness. Mighty hands for painting, paneling, and clicking the submit order button on homedepot.com to get that duvet. And these Egyptian cotton towels delivered right to your door. Do more with decor at the Home Depot. Save up to 30% on select bedding and bath. Now at homedepot.com. More saving, more kinds of doing. Valid on select items online only. Free delivery on select items $45 or more. Enter promo code BEDBATH15 at purchase for an extra 15% off. Visit homedepot.com for more information.
Welcome, everyone, to Creating a Family, talk about adoption and fostering. Today, we're going to be talking about a topic that is very near and dear to my heart, the impact of fostering on children already in the home. This is something we don't talk about enough. I am so glad that we're going to be, this is the topic today. Here's a sample of what you're going to hear.
They sometimes have a greater sense of empathy for the parent, so they tend to stress when the parent stresses. They tend to feel the anxiety of the parent because they're sitting back watching what's going on in the family, and they understand that their parent doesn't need any additional stress. So then they become a little less vocal about what it is that they may be feeling at the time.
This show is brought to you by Creating a Family. We are the National Adoption and Foster Care Education and Support Nonprofit. I'm Dawn Davenport. I am your host and the director of Creating a Family. You can find us and all of our resources online at creatingafamily.org. We are so happy that this show is underwritten by the Jockey Being Family Foundation. Their mission is to strengthen adoptive families through post-adoption services. As their founder, Deborah Waller, who is the chairman and CEO of Jockey International, as she says, one failed adoption is one too many. And all I can say is, yes, indeed, that is so true. You can support their mission by buying a bear or a blanket at their website, jockeybeingfamily.com. And we thank them for their support. This show, in addition to being underwritten by Jockey Being Family, is also supported by the generous support of organizations that believe in our mission of providing unbiased, accurate information and support to pre- and post-adoptive families and pre- and post-foster families as well, or pre- and active foster families. One of our wonderful sponsors and partners is Children's Connection. They're an adoption agency providing services for domestic infant adoption and embryo donation adoption throughout the U.S., as well as providing home studies and post-adoption support to families in Texas. Today we're going to be talking about the impact of fostering on children already in the home. This is a topic that, in my opinion, we don't talk enough about, and I believe that it is a hugely important topic to foster parents, and it influences their fostering experience. We'll be talking today with Dr. Mandy Howard. She is an assistant professor of psychology at Samford University, and she is an affiliate of the TCU Karen Purvis Institute of Child Development. We also have Dr. Eshelle Williams. She is a psychotherapist and a licensed marriage and family therapist. She is a board member of the National Foster Parent Association, and she is a birth child in a foster family. Welcome, Dr. Williams and Dr. Howard, to Creating a Family. I want to start with Dr. Williams. I want you to give us kind of a synopsis of your experience. I told you before that I thought some of you have great credentials. You research in this area, and you write in this area, and you teach in this area, and you present in this area of talking about the impact. But I honestly think that your greatest credentials is that you grew up in your case, it was a birth child, in a foster family. And in some ways, your experience is a cautionary tale. So can you give us just a brief synopsis of your experience as a child in a fostering family, as a child who was already in the home?
Thank you, Don, and I'm so pleased to be here. As I grew up in a foster family, my parents, my mother and father, were foster, adoptive, and kinship parents for 32 years of my life. I grew up with 8 foster siblings. They were joined with our family over a period of about 3 years or so. And as they were joined with our family, and as their mother continued to have children, the impact became greater and greater just in terms of the sheer number of children. I am one of four children that biological children of my mother and father, and with the addition of eight, we became a family with 12 children. So
good Lord.
With some of the,
that's a lot of kids.
Yes, just the sheer number is really great. I know that in other families they don't do that. It's not typical that they would allow eight children to join a family, but my mom's endeavor was to continue and to make sure that those children stayed together as they were one family, all brothers and sisters. In terms of the impact, when I was younger, the impact was a little less because I didn't understand the process that was going on with no education and no support and really no resources for my parents or my siblings and I. Much of what came as impact came later when I was a teenager, when myself and the children no longer got along, when we went to the same school but we had different friend groups, when I began to long for the support of my mother, but she was pulled in so many different directions that I was no longer getting that. So from the research and as I found, the attachment and the bonds that were created there when I was just the baby in the family was something that was lost. So I know we'll talk a little bit about birth order and how adding children to families can disrupt that system. What I've learned and what I experienced was that my relationship with my mother suffered. There were years where I wouldn't allow her to touch me because I didn't feel like she supported me the way that I needed. I became depressed in some ways. I found myself off at college in my own apartment, not leaving the house because something was going on and it just didn't feel right. I found myself in therapy as a result, trying to understand what the changes were that happened not only to myself but to my family. And as I looked at that, those changes came by way of not having enough time, support, and attention in as I was growing up. And part of that was as a result of adding so many more individuals to a family that was already functioning well. But when you have 12 children, there's only so much that you can do. I like to say you only have so much lap space. Right. So if you think about your lap in terms of how many children you can sit on your lap, when you've got 12, you've got children beyond your feet and you really kind of can't hug and love and do some of those things and attend to them the way you need to.
Well, you know, and when we work with agencies, when creating a family works with agencies on improving recruitment and retention of foster families, we say that fostering is a family affair. And we really mean that. I think that in the past, however, children already in the family and their needs have been overlooked. But we know from our experience and also from the research that one of the top reasons families stop fostering is because of their concern for how it is impacting their existing children. And we also know from our experience, and although I haven't read this in research, I believe that it would be proven, and that is also one of the reasons that parents hesitate to go into fostering. So It's a topic that any of us who care about foster kids and wanting to provide best care for them, it is being concerned about the children already in the family is crucial. But let's start with some of the positive impacts that fostering can have on the children already in the family when their parents become foster parents. Now, in addition, and I'm saying these might be in addition to some of the general benefits that can, don't always, but can come from having siblings, you know, such as ready-made playmates, learning to share, understanding that the world doesn't revolve completely around you, things such as that. Dr. Howard, can you tell us some of the positive attributes that foster and foster care can have for the children who are already in the home?
Oh, absolutely, and it's an honor to be on Creating a Family, so thank you all for having me. So some of the major things when you look at the literature for the positive effects are children, either the biological children or the adopted children that are permanently in the home, they learn how to serve others. They learn how to serve their community by welcoming children into their home. Many times when you look at the long-term literature on this, those children end up becoming foster carers themselves or they end up becoming actively involved in caring communities, so providing support systems and respite care. And it kind of becomes a life lesson for them and kind of a part of how they define and internalize self. We also know that they learn that it's not necessarily just mother and father that can serve as carers, and these family units are working together. So they recognize the importance of other people in their lives, and that families are something of a transition, and that you make and create your own family. And that's an important part of how you can think about and define self. Perhaps one of the biggest things that they learn is they just have this broad extension of the world around them. They understand and value how important family is, both in terms of the permanent family that they have, but also seeing some of the circumstances that their foster siblings are coming from. So they usually have a higher level of compassion, a higher level of maturity, and they're just long-term when we talk to children who were the permanent kids of adults and carers that fostered, they really just have this deep sense of the value of connection and being with others.
Excellent. Okay, Dr. Williams, can you add anything to that?
Yes. One of the things that you see with children is, and I think it's already been said, is just the sense of caring and understanding of another story. So the empathy is one of the things that really resonates with children, and understanding that they are a part of something bigger than themselves. They're able to give back, whether it be to one child or many children. In my case, it was understanding that sometimes moms and dads can't take care of their children and other people step up for them.
You know, understanding the value of stepping up. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And something that was not mentioned, but I think that we certainly have seen in our community is a greater openness and perhaps even enjoyment of diversity, that they have experienced more diversity in the most intimate of ways, their family. And so they are less threatened by it and often embrace it. And I think that is something that is certainly worthwhile. Dr. Howard, would you agree with me that I've not necessarily seen this in the research, but perhaps greater flexibility as well, because heaven only knows that flexibility is the hallmark of a healthy foster family. And so the children who are already in the home have to learn at least the value and hopefully the ability to be more flexible. Have you seen that as well?
Absolutely. Well, the literature on this is embarrassingly missing. It's not nearly as well studied as it should be, but in the literature that does exist, we absolutely find that. We also find that the children of foster carers are more likely to keep their eye on the goal of the process rather than the actual path and how you get there. So, thinking about trying to get a child to self-regulate, even when those children of foster carers become adults with their own children, when they're trying to get their children to self-regulate, they're working on the end goal. How can I get this child in a place where I can scaffold them to be successful, rather than all the steps in the process, which is often where we lose the forest for the trees. So flexible thinking in general, but also being able to kind of see that bigger picture and the outcome of that bigger picture.
Yeah, excellent. Well, in addition to, and I think that, and I think it was important to start with the positives, because the positives are absolutely there. But along with the positive influences and the positive impact on children already in family, there are some negatives, or shall we say some issues that children in the home face when their parents decide to foster. Dr. Williams, let's start with you, and let's talk about some. You mentioned one, and that was at the top of my list as well, and that is just less parental time, or as you said, less space in the lap. There's only so many adults, and the more children we add, just flat out the less time we have. What are some other things?
Some of the other things that children face are their inability to communicate effectively. As you add children to the family, sometimes, and not always, sometimes children's voices get lost. because they start to feel as if the challenges that they have are less important than the challenges that a child joining the family may have. If a child has educational challenges and the birth child or the previously adopted child does not have those same educational challenges, asking for support with homework when they do and if they do have a challenge might be something that they don't do. They sometimes have a greater sense of empathy for the parent, so they tend to stress when the parent stresses. They tend to feel the anxiety of the parent because they're sitting back watching what's going on in the family, and they understand that their parent doesn't need any additional stress. So then they become a little less vocal about what it is that they may be feeling at the time. Some of the things that can also impact is in terms of parental time, where they may have an event outside of the home. They may have, parents may miss out on that event, and there's some hurt feelings that go along with that, but they won't express those hurt feelings. Mm-hmm. I know that one of the things that I experienced going along was even in getting my master's degree, my mother was not able to separate herself and attend to me as an adult, and because she was still caring for smaller children, babies at that time, because she adopted two of my cousins' children as well. So you see a lot of these things that are happening with children and families in terms of separation from parents. That's a lifelong challenge that families go through, not only when their children are small.
Okay. Dr. Howard, can you add some of the other negatives or things that foster parents need to be very cognizant of to make certain that they don't become big negatives?
Absolutely. So some of the big issues when you're talking with children of foster carers is you hear them saying things like, well, there were discrepancies in discipline. They disciplined me differently than they disciplined the children that were in foster care. And, you know, sometimes that's very necessary, but they don't always understand the underlying reason of why that is the case. We want to protect our children that are in the home, but in the same respect, they need to have an active voice and understanding of what it means to be a foster family, and that they are an active part of that component. Some organizations are getting better at making sure the permanent children in the home are receiving training as well, but it's still not great. Another thing that we know is children that are in foster care are usually there for a reason beyond their control, so abuse, neglect, et cetera, but this affects their behavior. And so we'll see increased problematic behavior, so things like cursing, things like dishonesty, stealing, et cetera. And many times the children that have permanently been in the home haven't been exposed to this. And so they see these behaviors, and it can be hard for them to trust. It can be hard for them to understand why these behaviors are going on. From the foster child's perspective, this was a survival strategy that kept them alive and kept them safe prior to coming into the home. And part of the fostering parent process is teaching them more adaptive strategies, but that takes time. And so we need for our children that are in the home to understand that this is a part of the process. I hear you. Your concerns are important to me. You know, action will be taken, but they're learning. I think another big negative side of it, and these are kind of two sides of the same coin, by the nature of foster care, our goal is to reunify families if we can. We want to bring people back together, which means that just in a natural foster placement, there's going to be transition and there's going to be grief and loss. This doesn't necessarily have to be a bad thing. The children that are permanently in the home are going to experience this, and as the caregiver, you can scaffold them through that process. But we need to acknowledge that is going to be an important part of the process. We often think about post-placement as being a time of reflection and a time of grieving, and that's okay. And not only as foster carers do we need to do that, but we need to give our children that are still in home an opportunity to do that as well. The last piece that I kind of want to highlight, and this is probably one, it's not well documented in the literature, but when you talk to children of foster carers, it often comes up. They have a sense of insecurity in the home. I've often heard parents say when I've gone to foster parent support groups or gone to speaking engagements, well, my biological four-year-old asked me the other day when they were going to go to their new home. Because they don't necessarily understand. They think children coming and going is just a normal part of family. So being sure to explain that. But particularly if you have adopted children in the home that
right.
come from that history of transition, they're acutely aware of the coming and going of the foster children. And even if they know, right, that they're a permanent part of their family, there's always going to be that thought in the back of their head that am I going to be going to the new family next? So again, it's there, but acknowledging it's there, being proactive when we talk to them about it, so they feel like their voice is being heard.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up. And one of the reasons we were careful with the titling of this is of this interview was to make certain that it's we acknowledge the fact that it's not only birth children in the home, but also children who have been adopted. And from what I'm hearing you say, Dr. Howard, the children that have been adopted may be at greater risk for this feeling of insecurity because they come from a placement, or from, they come from to your family from a situation of loss and therefore are more heightened to it. And then we're going to talk in a bit about some of the things that parents can do to work around this. I wanted to read something from one of our community members. She says, her name is Jenny. She says, one thing I want people to know is the lost children in the home also experience when new people move in and leave. My kids have had to deal with so much, and I think that is one of the hard truths that we as parents have to consider when deciding to renew our foster license. So I think I'm so glad you raised that, Dr. Howard, because I believe that that is relevant for so many of us, so many foster families. We also have a comment from our community that, and let me just stop and say that this is an interview with Creating a Family, and one of the things we do at Creating a Family is we have a very large online support group, and you can find that, and we would love to have you join it. You can find that. It's a Facebook closed group, so you can go to facebook.com/groups and then Creating a Family. It is a closed group, and you have to be admitted, but we will do that. We'd love to have you join us. Anyway, one of our community members submitted this. She said, my kids are frustrated and express it often to my husband and I about what they think of as different expectations and disciplining for our foster kids and for them. We do have different expectations, and we have to pick our battles very carefully, especially with our current placement. I can see how that looks unfair to them, and we have tried to explain why we are doing it, but I'm not really sure how to handle it because it doesn't seem to be working. They are still frustrated. I would love suggestions. Dr. Howard had raised this as one of the negatives. Our community has raised it as a negative. Can you give us some suggestions for parents? Oftentimes they need to have different expectations. The children come in from different backgrounds, different experiences, and then oftentimes we do have to pick our battles, and we're moving towards an end goal, but it's going to take a while. But do we relax our standards for all of our kids? If so, wouldn't we have, chaos and bedlam?
At some point, what we have to continue to do is communicate. We have to communicate early. We have to communicate often, because what happens is our children do not understand. And as we say, they may not have an issue because they don't raise an issue. But for us, if we understand exactly what our children are facing, then we have to bring it to them. I know this might look different for you, or I know my expectation of you may be higher. And they're explaining why it is that the expectations are different. I believe that if children were socialized early into the fostering process, meaning with in pre-service, when families were thinking about becoming foster families and they went to pre-service training, if the agency that they worked with had some supports for children, then they would answer those questions, and once they felt the discipline issue or change or challenge in the family, they would already have a knowledge base to go back and identify and say, they said this was going to happen or that I might experience this. So they wouldn't have so much of a challenge bringing it up or understanding it. So part of it is making sure that they're educated and that they're brought along within the process. And the other part that the literature says, sometimes birth children and previously adopted children can look further or more impacted than the foster child. And part of that reason is there are no supports and services. So if your child starts to raise question or they start to feel the discrepancy, some gaps in the parenting or your ability and parents' ability to be attentive to them, it's understanding that they also need support, and that support may not just come from their parents, but the support comes from outside services such as support groups or individual therapy, which we understand that there's no funding for at this moment. So it's making sure that you get them the supports and services that they need in a timely manner so that the problem doesn't escalate.
You know, one of the things that you said that I just want to circle back to, because I think it is so important, even if our children, in this case, in the question that we received, her children were communicating with their parents that they were frustrated and they thought things were unfair and they were not being treated equally. But what I heard you say was that even if our kids are not the ones who verbalize it, we should bring it up with them, because their lack of communication with us may mean that they're not experiencing it, but it may just mean that they don't want to add stress to our lives, or they don't think we can do anything about it or whatever. So I hope I heard you correctly, Dr. Williams, and that is to bring it up, any issues that you think your kids could be feeling, bring it up and air it, give it some airing, and your kids can say, nah, you know, I understand, or they can say, yeah, you know, I think you're being unfair. So I think that was really important. Did I catch your drift correctly, Dr. Williams?
Absolutely. So you give your children an opportunity to say, I felt that last week, but I'm not feeling it anymore. And parents can follow up and say, well, how come you didn't bring it up to me? Oh, well, we were going through this at that period of time. But they know that there's a challenge there. They know the parents would like to hear what they have to say, so they'd be more likely to bring it up in the future because they know that the parents see it and they recognize it. Part of the problem is they don't feel like people recognize what they're going through, and the research calls them the unknown soldiers of foster care. So how do we make known the challenges that they're going to face, and how do parents do that before the children have to come and do it for themselves?
And if we let them know that it is okay to talk about this, that we're not threatened by it, then they're more likely to bring it up when they do feel it.
Absolutely.
Dr. Howard, I wanted to ask you a question that we hear this from people before they foster. I will be honest that I don't hear this too much from families that are actively in fostering. I'm not sure why, but the parents
they're too tired to ask.
Exactly. It's like, it slipped down on my list of things. If there's no blood on the ground, we're having a good day. The parents before they foster will often tell us that they're afraid that their kids will begin to act in disrespectful ways or the ways that are problematic that the foster child. And you had mentioned that obviously that our foster children come to us with coping mechanisms, and those coping mechanisms are often not the behaviors that are productive for them or that we want to see in our children, lying, stealing, manipulating, and things such as that. Not all foster children do that, but it's not unheard of. And so parents beforehand say, oh, gosh, my kids are going to see somebody lying, and they're going to want to do that. And do you see that happening often in actuality in foster families, or is that a concern for families beforehand, but it really seldom plays out, or do you know?
When you look at families on the ground, so particularly during the first foster placement, when you're kind of getting your sea legs and learning about how your family is going to operate and, you know, what this is going to look like for your family, many times what we learn is around those sorts of issues. So, for example, cursing. You know, most families that foster don't allow cursing in their home. And so when the foster child comes in, if they use this creative language, sometimes their children will pick that up. But what they try to do and what successful families do is very early on set clear boundaries on the expectations for behavior, both for the foster child but also for the rest of the children in the home. You know, I understand that you're trying to express a concern to me, but I need you to use your good words, right? And these are some other words that you can use to tell me what you need. I don't recommend that you do that in the moment of a tantrum. It's not very effective. But,
no,
you know, thinking about it ahead of time, so thinking of the foster child, if they are using this this cursing language, when they're in a good place ahead of time, you know, well, when you were upset, you used some of these words. What are some better words that we could use, right? And even bringing the biological kids, it's like what you were trying to communicate was, I'm angry with you. What are some other ways that we could say that? And even bringing the biological kids alongside, so again, they don't feel that discrepancy in discipline, saying there are so many words to choose from. We can get so creative with the words that we choose. Let's find some better ones that we can use in our house. I was working with one family that had an older child in the home. They had fostered out of birth order. And their younger children had, both foster children and biological children, had adopted or adapted to some of the cursing language. So they came up with their own pseudo-cursing vocabulary in the family. So they used words like Bartlenugan. And, you know, they talked about this. Like, these words are not okay. These are the words, and this is the boundary. But you can say these words, and I would rather you express your emotion than just the, you know, the words behind them. Telling me a curse word doesn't tell me how you feel and how I can help support you. So you do see it, but families that are successful are usually the ones that draw those boundaries very early and bring those biological and those permanent children under wing during those conversations so they have clear ideas of what the expectations are.
All right. We talk about foster families, that it's the whole family. And so when a family is deciding to become a foster family, we got a number of questions of children in the family wanting to specify ages and gender of the child, and often asking for an older foster sibling or a foster sibling of the same gender. So let's talk a little about that. How much say and understanding why a child in the family would want to specify the age and the gender, because the reality is the more specific we are on what our family, and the more limited, I should say, about what we are on what our family will accept, the less useful it is for the foster workers and the foster agency, because they may not have a 3-year-old girl, and that's for whatever reason that family or that the child in that family wants. Dr. Williams, can you talk a little about that, in particular, a child in the family specifying that, okay, I'm okay with fostering, but I want it to be older than me, and I want it to be an older sister, you know, that type of thing.
As we know, we all have our fantasies, and we have our fantasies about most things, right? What we want in a mate, or what we want in, you know, the next home you buy or the next car you buy. And
or
I think
how our children are going to behave. Let me say, I have a fantasy there. But.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely,
yeah.
Right? I want my 4-year-old to behave in the best way. And if he doesn't, at least do it while we're out. So, you know,
that's
at home
fantasy.
Is a different story, right?
Well,
so,
as long as you're fantasizing, I
think,
I want both, but okay.
So,
go ahead,
so do I, right? We often don't get that. So as we know, children have fantasies, and at some point
they don't want to go through the loss of what it may feel like to be displaced from their role or who they see themselves as in the family. If I was the baby in the family and there was a big emphasis put on having this baby status. So I didn't want to lose that. I wasn't asked if what child or if someone was going to join our family, what I would want that to be or who I would want that to be. So I didn't get that opportunity. But I do see in families where, or in the literature, they talk about not joining a child that's older than your child because, you know, there might be some challenges there. But I feel like there are going to be challenges no matter what child joins the family. Preference may be about birth order so that you can continue to call yourself the baby in the family or you can always be the oldest child in the family. But as we look at it, I had older siblings and I had younger siblings. I think for me in particular, losing that baby status because there were four actual babies that came home from the hospital, I felt replaced in a lot of ways. As the babies came in, you don't ever want your child to feel as if there's someone that can replace them. I understood later on that that was not true, but it was the feeling. So I do think we try the best that we can in a situation where there's a bunch of unknowns to say, if it just looked like this, if I had my fantasy, then it might go really, really well, or I might be pleased. So I think that's a part of it. Adding some knowns to an unknown situation. I think that inherent with the fact that there's going to be changes when you join a child with a family, we try to minimize the changes by saying exactly what it is we want.
Let me read a comment or question actually from someone in our community, Shelby. She says, "We are so close to becoming foster parents. My husband and I couldn't be more excited. However, our 7-year-old daughter is starting to show some attitude. Her dad told her to do something, and she looked at him and said, 'You're not the boss. I only listen to mommy.' This is 100% not her. She is always happy and excited when we discuss fostering and adoption, and she is really eager to help. She has a stipulation that I find weird, but she wants only an older sister or one the same age as her, and she doesn't want a little sister. I've also noticed she is crying at night. I try to listen through the door, but I can't make out what she is babbling about. And when I go into her room to talk to her about what's wrong, she says she doesn't want to grow up, and that's why she's crying. Is this normal? Should I be worried about going forward with fostering?" Dr. Howard, thoughts on this? I think it fits in some, especially the part about only wanting an older sister. And not wanting to grow up. So let's talk some about and give some perhaps practical advice or at least some insight to Shelby about what her daughter might be going through.
Absolutely. So a couple of things to keep in mind, and I think Dr. Williams did a great job highlighting this, is when those specific requests are made, right, there's an underlying question or an underlying need below them. So when I say, I want to be an only child, it might be saying something like, I'm worried that I'm not going to be important anymore. I'm worried about sharing you. As Dr. Williams said, if I want to make sure that I'm the youngest, I'm worried about not being the baby and being able to fulfill that role. So any of those questions that our kids ask or any of those statements that they ask, try to read between the lines. Right. So at the end of the day, that statement that, many of our children, particularly at age 7 or anywhere in the elementary school age range, they don't have the words to be able to communicate what they mean. Right. So try to read between the lines and, see if there's this other issue. Specific to the birth order idea, one of the things that we do find is, and this is both a positive and a negative for children in a foster family home, is they're usually expected to be a mentor, and that's often words that are used when they're prepping for the foster placement for the first time. In many ways, that means from their perspective, I'm going to have more responsibility, right? I'm going to have to step up, and I'm going to have to be that person that is kind of the role model. And that's one of the benefits to fostering and being a child in a family that fosters. But in the same respect, that's a lot of responsibility for a 7-year-old. So maybe talk a little bit about what those expectations are going to be. Many times on the parent's part, when a child is placed in the home, those expectations and responsibilities are inadvertent, right? So you know that your children that have been permanently in the home for years and years, they know how to go through the routine of doing their homework. So as opposed to the typical routine, you'll just say, oh, go ahead and do your homework, and you're going to spend your time over here trying to really scaffold the child that's new in the home. They're not used to, the children that have been in the home aren't used to that high level of responsibility, and many times they're afraid they're going to disappoint, and that's why they're worried about it.
Yeah, I can absolutely see that. Let me read another comment that came in, and this actually harkens back a little to what Dr. Williams had said a little about her own personal experience. This is from Tina. Our daughter does not want us to foster a child who attends her school. That will be pretty hard because we live in a smallish town with only a couple of schools for each age range. Our agency feels like this would really limit us unless we accept kids from outside of our county. But then that they would be attending our daughter's school once they are in our home. We don't know why she feels so strongly, and we don't understand how much we should honor her wishes. Dr. Williams, you had talked about that one of the issues for you is being in the same school as your siblings, your foster siblings. Let's talk some about help Tina tease out some of her daughter's issues. If she doesn't want to be in school, why? What are some reasons behind what her daughter? I assume she's asking. Her daughter hasn't been able to give her a reason, and also what she as a mom can do about this.
I think some of the challenges that happen when you join children with families is there are so many changes that if I could only deal with the changes at home, maybe I would be able to understand those before I have to add them into all of the other elements or places in my life. So when we think about joining children and what it means for her child in school is that now people know that they may think that she's a foster child. They also might not understand what it means for her family to be a foster family, so there may be a little bit of stigma. I understand that, and what we understand from working in social services is that it's never been popular to be a foster child. It may not be popular to be a foster family. So there may be questions that come where her friends may not understand or she might not know how to express that her family is a foster family. So it's part of this may be education and thinking about how do we move her along and bring her forward so that when the intrusive questions come or inappropriate questions come, she has the language to be able to talk about those things and educate other people, as well as looking at the responsibility that she has to take on in school. Does it mean that she's now going to have to support this child and acclimate them to school when maybe she might be having some challenges on her own? Or you look at the jealousy part. What if my friends like her or him better than they like me?
Mm-hmm.
Or we get to also think about the rivalry that might exist. How many more of my things do I have to share? I have to share my mom and dad. I have to share my room. If there's a pet in the family, may have to share my pet, parental time and attention. And now I have to extend that and make a bridge to sharing every single thing that's just mine. So the child might be saying, I want to keep something solely for me. So can I have some separation at least at school so I have something that continues to just be mine?
You know, and also there is, just to call it out, sometimes there is an embarrassment because the foster sibling may behave poorly at school or may do inappropriate things or use inappropriate language. And if that person is considered your sister or brother, even if we have the adjective foster first, it would be easy to think it might reflect upon a child, for a child to think that it might reflect upon them.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So what would you so in this case, as Tina points out, even if they took children only from outside the county, they would be then attending if they were within the age range of their daughter, they would be in the same school. What's a parent to do?
I would suggest that the parents think about what are all of the possible things that my child might be worried about and make a list. And if she makes a list of those things, take it to the child and say, is this a concern of yours? So what we want to do is we want to give some verbiage and language to our children so that they can say, this is what I've been thinking about. So mom is going to be really smart at that moment, and she's going to say, my child might be thinking or going through this. And when she brings it to the child, you say, is this what you're worried about? And you make a plan. If that is a concern, then how are we going to handle it? So it really is mitigating some of the challenge or issues that are going to arise, or what we can do is kind of quiet some of the noise and anxiety in the child's head or the fear of what might actually happen. And there's sometimes that if we decide to continue with fostering and adopting, there are some things that are inevitable. The child may have to go to your school. So let's make a plan that if the child is there, then this is how we're going to proceed. If you have a question, then we're going to answer the question in this way. You can reserve not to answer. So really giving some option for the child, especially if we understand that the child is going to have to go to that school anyway. So I know for me, my mom couldn't fix every single problem, but as long as we strategized around it, then I was able to accept it better than if I just had to deal with it. So we really want to have some strategy.
At least you feel like you've been heard. And sometimes even if they can't solve the problem and make it go away, knowing that that your parents understand and respect what you're going through is all it really takes.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Let's talk some about disrupting birth order through fostering. It is the reality for many foster families, and for foster families who feel very strongly that they don't want to disrupt birth order, they often have an extended wait, depending, of course, on the age of the children already in the family. Dr. Howard, what are your thoughts on disrupting birth order through fostering? And that's the first question. And then the second one that I'd like to hear from both of you on is if the foster family decides to disrupt birth order, what are some things that the family can do to mitigate some of the negative impacts of disrupting birth order? But first, let's talk about just the general gist and the idea behind disrupting birth order. Dr. Howard?
Yeah. So one of the things that we know, so birth order or just the family unit in general, I like to think about like a nursery mobile, right, that hangs above the crib. If you pull on one of those little animal characters, it disrupts the whole mobile, and everybody has found their place in the family, right? They know where they are in the family characteristics. So anytime you add a child, it's going to disrupt the mobile, and we're going to need to readjust. So that's one thing to keep in mind about birth order. There's going to be disruption regardless. That's just the nature of bringing a new person into your home. I think, again, going back to some of the things that Dr. Williams said, making sure that if your child voices that concern, that you look for the underlying reasons below it, right? So what is the need that we're trying to meet? From a very practical perspective, I'm a very practical person at the end of the day. My main concern with birth order is, especially if you have children in the home that don't have the verbal ability to communicate if something is wrong. So many times when I'm working with nonprofit organizations that do foster placements, birth order for children that are relatively close in age, we can be a little flexible there. But if you have very young children in the home, you want to make sure that everybody's protected and everybody's safe. So making sure that they have the words and that they have a strategy in place if something does happen to them to keep them safe. There are some situations where, as I said, it's a little bit easier to move and disrupt birth order than others. But with the very, very young children in the home, we have to be extra careful to make sure everybody in the house is safe and protected.
Well, and let me just raise that we have a very specific situation is children who, when you are accepting the foster placement of a child who is acting out sexually because of past sexual abuse, mm-hmm. That is a different form of safety that needs to be talked about and is beyond what we can talk about in this course, in this interview. But we do have a number of courses at Creating a Family that are specifically that specifically target families who are considering adopting or fostering a child who has been sexually abused, and with some very specific examples of what families need to think about beforehand. We also have a couple of courses on disrupting birth order itself and through adoption or fostering, again, with some very, very specific ideas of what to do. But before we move off of disrupting birth order, or adopting or fostering out of birth order, another way it's often described, Dr. Williams, do you have any thoughts specific to that, and in particular what parents, things that parents need to consider if they're going to do it?
I think parents have to consider their child's role in the family. Nobody likes to lose place or position, and as you think about bringing in a younger child, just what we call children, the baby or my baby, and now you're going to introduce or join another baby with the family, it's not. It's really solidifying that role. This is what it means for you to be my baby. I gave birth to you. I do these things. Mommy and Daddy feel this way about you, so that the child knows and understands that all of those things are not erased because a younger child is joined with the family. And if it is an older child, then saying, you know, this child will play this role, this is the role that you will continue to play, because what children really want to understand is, am I being, they want to know if they're being replaced or if another person could take their spot. And we want to solidify for them, and we really want to have in-depth conversations about mommy and daddy's heart is this big, and it doesn't matter if a child is older or younger than you, you still have that space in our heart. And once we do introduce the child into the family, a lot of what the literature talks about and where we understand some of the challenges that can go on are from blended families, when you have mom and dad that have been divorced and now remarried, and you have to introduce and integrate all of the children together. It's looking at how are we going to manage those characteristics and the things that might come up in terms of clashes. And I love what we've been talking about and saying, it's really about the safety of the child and thinking, what might my child be thinking or feeling when they say this or when I do that? So we really want to have some forethought so that we can answer some of those questions or give language to what the child might be feeling.
Excellent. And something you talked about at the very beginning, Dr. Williams, in your own personal situation, was the sheer number of children added to the family over a relatively short period of time. However, we know that one of the realities of foster care is, and for foster agencies who are seeking families, is they often have sibling groups. Now, perhaps not a sibling group of eight, and I realize that yours didn't start off as eight coming at one fell swoop, but they came all pretty quickly. So,
But that is
the reality. We often have sibling groups. So talk to us some about the impact of the number of children in one placement and how that affects the adjustment of the family. And then things that parents need to think about for characteristics they need to assess as whether their family would be the right one for, say, a sibling group of three or four or five or whatever.
In terms of sibling groups, we understand that that particular sibling group is going to come with their own bonds. They may come with their own bonds, their own language, some shared experiences that a child that is already in the family doesn't understand or know about. So we have to be aware of the challenge of that child that's already in the family breaking into a sibling group, and knowing that they'll have to be acclimated and there'll be some adjustment that needs to take place. So what we want to understand is, how do the siblings get along? Because not every sibling group gets along very well. And how are they going to integrate the child that's already in the family into their group? So what we see is that rivalry that exists. And we want to try to mitigate that rivalry as much as possible. So on the front end, we would really need to understand, how do the siblings perform together? Have they all been together previously? And if they haven't, then we understand that they've maybe been socialized in three different families, if it's a sibling group of three, and the roles and rules and dynamics of that family are also going to be different. So we prepare ourselves for that. So as much upfront information that we have is going to be the best. In terms of number, we want to make sure that the children that are joining the family don't overshadow the child that's already there. We make sure that we spend specific time and we have activities that we do just with children that are already in the family, and then some activities that we do together, so that there's not so much loss created in terms of support that the birth child or the previously adopted child receives. So for me, in our family, the numbers were overwhelming. And the way that I dealt with that is I moved with my grandmother. I was in kinship care, informal kinship care, for a long time. So it's making sure that they have other individuals that they can go to. Like, we talk about respite for foster children, but what about respite and other people caring for our children, because things might become overwhelming? So we really expand our friend group, and we have our support system that if it does become overwhelming for the child that's already there, they also have a place to go.
Okay. All right. Now I want to move to the most practical part of this interview, and that is, what are some tips that you can give for families that would help them integrate foster children into their family as painlessly as possible to form a supportive and cohesive family for all the children in the home? And I think what I'll do is, Dr. Howard, I'll start with you. You give a tip, then I'll go to Dr. Williams, and then we'll go back and forth. And we've already mentioned, I should say, so feel free to highlight some that have already been brought up, because a number of tips have already been mentioned. So, Dr. Howard, in no particular order, I won't always hate it when people put pressure and say, this is start with your number one tip. I have a personality to go, oh, gosh, I don't know. Wait, is that number one? I can't even choose my favorite color. I drive every six-year-old crazy when they ask that. What's your favorite color? And I go, well, it kind of depends on the mood. It kind of depends on what I'm doing. So anyway, I'm not doing that to you, okay? I'm just saying, just in no particular order, throw out a tip that you would want for families to help them integrate children already in the home with incoming foster kids.
So there's a lot of them, but we've talked about this a little bit throughout the interview, but just to really highlight it, spend time together with each of the children individually. And in that time, really be psychologically and emotionally present. I'm here with you in this moment. And have this be a regular occurrence. Don't have it be something that just happens every now and then, but once a week, this is our time together, that this is 30 minutes that it's just me and you. It's nice to do, I always say, like, go on a date with your child and go out to Sonic or whatever the case may be, but that's not necessarily the environment that you need to have. You need to create this space where you and each child has some time together. A great example is in my household, our dishwasher broke about 3 years ago, and we have not fixed it yet. And, I mean, part of it is just because we haven't gotten there, but the main reason is because this has provided a space where every night one of the children and I wash our dishes together, and that is 20 minutes every night that we are together, that one of my children gets to spend some time with me, and I get to hear every word that they say. Another great time for that is at the end of the day. So when you're tucking children in at night, I always like to joke that if you ask a child in the afternoon, how was your day, you get silence. If you ask an 8-year-old how their day was at the end of the night, and they know that they can stay up a little bit later if they talk to you, suddenly you get the intimate details of their day, because they think they're getting to stay up later because of it. So find those precious moments where you can be with each child and really spend that time together and communicate and listen to not just the words that they say, but the messages below those words.
Excellent. Dr. Williams.
I've actually done quite a bit of research in thinking about what I would have liked to have done for myself, as well as what I hear children and families talk about today. And I created an acronym. It's ASAIP. And what we want to do is acknowledge, support, advocate, include, and protect. And one of the ways that we can do that is through education. We can educate not only ourselves, but our children about the process of fostering and adopting. And we can do that through pre-service training. We can go to support groups. We can also do that through the ongoing support from the agency social workers. And just what we're doing now, radio shows and making sure that we attend trainings and that the trainings are open to our children as well, because they need to hear this. They're valuable members of the team, and we have to recognize them as such.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and let me say now then, we will include a link to this article, but Dr. Ishelle Williams has written on this topic and on the acronym, and it is in the Fostering Families Today magazine, May-June 2018, and we will link to it so that you can access that article. Okay. So we've got spend time together individually with your kids and make sure that's a part of your regular schedule and that it actually happens on a regular basis. We have educate, include our kids in the training beforehand, educate them on the experience. All right, Dr. Howard, another tip that you could give families.
This is more about kind of the post-placement side of it. So when you're in that transition from having one child going out of the home and considering having another child going in, those transitions are really important. We need to make sure that we take this time to create equilibrium. One of the things that we know in the developmental literature on any family is to be in a healthy state, you need to have balance. And there are going to be seasons in the life of every family that fosters where you can take on more or perhaps you should take on less. I have a very dear friend who's been fostering for years and years and years, and their family decided to take a respite because she had two children starting kindergarten, one child starting high school, and one child graduating from high school, all within about 12 months. So taking this time, saying, all right, we need equilibrium, we need to find balance, and once we have that, we can open our home again. There's no shame in that. And it's an important part to recognize that sometimes you and sometimes your children need that time of quiet and reflection before you're ready to serve our children in the foster system.
Yeah, that's a get yourself back in balance before you bring another child in, and also allow your child and yourself to grieve the loss of this mm-hmm. child that has been with you. It seems awfully, and I think sometimes it's parents, but also, quite frankly, sometimes it's agencies that don't make it harder for parents to demand that they
mm-hmm.
have that time. Yeah. All right, Dr. Williams.
We want to take the time to acknowledge and discuss the feelings of our children in an age-appropriate manner. One of the things that often happens is parents ask children how they're feeling only at one interval in time, and they don't continue to ask the questions. Just as an adopted child needs to understand throughout their life that they are adopted, because it's not okay or it's not enough to tell them only at, let's say, age 4, because by the time they're 8, their brain has developed in a different way, so do our biological children and children already in the family need to understand on a continual basis. As their brains become more mature, and they begin to develop, the age-appropriate conversation is also going to develop about why we are a foster family, how long this process, or we are going to be a part of the process. So it's asking and continuing to bring this up and acknowledging their feelings at
intervals during their lives, they're going to feel different at age 4 than they do at 8, than they do at 15. At 4, it might have been really great, but at 15, the feelings may have changed, and we need to make sure that we're checking in with our children when at times where the feelings may change.
And I'm going to add one, and it's the one that I think, Dr. Williams, you said earlier. Don't assume that if your children are not telling you they're feeling frustrated, or they have an issue, or they're not happy with the way things are, don't assume that that means they're not feeling it. They may very well be protecting you by not saying it, so that the burden of communication falls on us as parents to bring it up. We don't have to be pushy. We don't have to, you know, shove it down their throats or make them feel what they don't feel. But we have to give them permission to know that it is okay to have these feelings. And sometimes that means saying, are you feeling this way? Are you embarrassed? Are you angry? Are you feeling jealous? Or, you know, whatever. Name it. So I will throw that one out there as well.
This is Dr. Williams.
Go ahead.
This is Dr. Williams. I'm sorry. It's actually, and Don, I'm glad you said that, because you're going to say, I've noticed that you've been changing. I've noticed that you've been experiencing this lately. You name it for them, and hopefully they can own it.
Yeah, so you name it, let them own it if they want.
If they can.
Yeah, if they can. I always say, for conversation starters or conversations, I throw the ball. It's my responsibility to throw the ball. It's their decision on whether to catch it or not. But I have to be the one who starts with the toss. And then sometimes they'll catch it, and sometimes they'll say, no, I'm not feeling that, even if I think they are. All right, Dr. Howard.
And this is another point that's kind of been highlighted throughout, but the importance of support across the board. So we've gotten better as a culture about supporting foster carers. There are support groups out there, although most of the time that they're meeting, they're focusing on best practices and how to support each other in caring for foster children. So using those support groups from the foster carer's perspective as a mechanism to also understand and how we can best care for all of our children that are in the home, including those that are permanently there. That's a natural avenue where there's decades of experience in the room, and making sure that when we have that precious time with a support group, we're using it, and we're using it in the full spectrum of strengths and challenges within the foster caring process, but also recognizing that our children need those support networks in place as well. There's not as many as I would like. Some agencies do a good job of having some support mechanisms in place for children that are permanently in the home, but finding those groups and finding those support networks for our children to be able to talk about these things in a meaningful way with their peers, if it's at all possible.
Well, can you suggest, because you're right, number one, if you don't live in a fairly large metropolitan area, it's really hard to have a functioning support group because you need to have numbers. So that's one issue. Two, foster families are busier than the average because, number one, they have more children. Number two, a lot of their kids have appointments and meetings and visitations with birth families, doctor's appointments, therapy appointments, blah, 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 tutoring. So they're really busy, and so getting a family to an in-person support meeting is hard. And three, very often these support meetings are for the parents and there's just babysitting for the kids. So do you know of things that, of ways, camps, online support groups, things specifically that we could suggest? Because quite frankly, I'm often at a loss for this.
Yeah, so as you said at the beginning of the interview, I was the assistant director of the Karen Purvis Institute of Child Development for a number of years, and they hosted therapeutic summer camps for children that were adopted and were in foster care, but probably the most important thing that we did is the entire family was welcome at those camps because everybody needs support through the process. So there are lots of resources on that piece of it at the Institute of Child Development's website, but they also have other organizations that they have trained to do camps like that. They literally are happening all over the world. Another mechanism that I'm trying to work on, particularly in the area that I'm in, is one, being strategic. So if you are that person that's leading a support group, try to find benefits. They always say if you bring child care, food, and continuing education credit, they will come. Mm-hmm. So trying to find mechanisms to do that within the support group for the parents, because they need that continuing education credit. But I've been working with several, particularly in the area that I'm in, church communities that have these support groups that are also starting smaller support groups or camp-like environments during childcare. So they're not, I mean, they are playing because that's how children learn, but also kind of providing a support group for all of the kids in the home during that childcare process. And they often get a lot of benefit out of that. And they also are with a continuing group of kids, which will help.
And is there curriculum for that you can recommend for the support group that's being conducted for the children? Or is that just mainly an area where the children play together rather than really discuss and having it more of an active support group?
Yeah, so it depends on the age of the children. We have curriculum that we've been putting in place, and it's based on principles. So, you know, from the Karen Purvis Institute of Child Development, they have trust-based relational intervention, which is developed for children with a history of trauma, but at the end of the day, it's just good human development. So a lot of the curriculum is based on that. So how to share feelings, how to talk about grief and loss, which is important for all of the kids that are in our home. For older children, some of that curriculum is in place too, because you want to make sure you're being developmentally appropriate. Another great source, Dan Siegel, who is an author and a neuroscientist, has a lot of books that it's not geared specifically towards foster. It's not geared specifically to foster families, but a lot of books on how we can kind of think around these processes and understand how they're affecting us. And I've actually had several church groups in the area that I'm in, and I'm in a large metropolitan area, so there's this network in place where they have teenagers that during the parent meetings, they have a book club, and they go through chapter by chapter and talk about, not just because of the foster aspect, but in general, talk about some of the things that they're encountering in their life because they're coming from a non-traditional family, and that's okay. So that's been very successful as well, to kind of have that book group in place.
Yeah, I've seen that work really well. And sometimes, and quite often, it works best when you're reading a fiction book that
yes.
is a YA book, because it's sometimes safer to talk about things in that context. Excellent. And Dr. Williams, I'm going to give you the last one, suggestions and tips for families.
Seek support. So that goes along mm-hmm. with what we've been talking about, and that support might come in the way of professional help. So as a therapist, I understand how important it is to have an impartial, sometimes third party, to discuss thoughts and feelings with. We understand trauma, loss, and grief, and that all of our children are experiencing that through the changes that they go through in life. So just as foster children that join the family come with a team that supports them, we have to develop a team that is going to support our children that are already in the family so that they continue to be stable members of the family that might potentially be the next generation of foster and adoptive parents. So we can't leave out the support that they need. I remember wanting and needing therapy but not knowing how to ask for it. Mm-hmm. So I would ask to go along with the children that were there. Sometimes I could, but other times I couldn't. And as I think about the challenge that we face now, there are no supports or very few supports for our children in the way of having some professional help that talks about
foster care and adoption and how they are impacted on a continual basis. If we could find money for that, you know, I'd give $5 for every child out of my own pocket so that they could at least have a mandatory 6 sessions once the child joins the family, maybe a couple while they're there, and then as children transition from the family, just so that they would have a place to know that they could say anything that they wanted to and experience a range of feelings, because there are a range from happy to devastated when a child leaves, because we understand that there are triumphs and challenges to the process that we, you know, embark our children upon or sometimes push on them, because as parents we want what we want. So
I love that idea. Making sure, just having your child with a therapist for the first 2 months of a placement and during transitions, and then you at least have somebody in place. If we could just find funding, right?
Absolutely.
Okay, well, we can always wish. All right, thank you so much, Dr. Ishelle Williams, who is she's on the board member of the National Foster Parent Association, and she is a licensed marriage and family therapist. And thank you, Dr. Mandy Howard. She is assistant professor of psychology at Samford and affiliated with the TCU, Karen Purvis Institute of Child Development. Thank you so much for being with us today. Let me remind everybody that this show and all the resources we provide could not happen and, quite frankly, would not happen without the generous support of our partners. One of our partners is Adoptions from Shepherd Care. They are a nonprofit adoption agency founded in 1980, providing domestic infant adoption, international adoption from Colombia, and domestic and Hague-approved international home studies. Their mission is to provide competent and compassionate adoption services to expectant moms, birth moms or birth parents, and prospective adoptive families and the children who need a forever family. Thank you so much for joining us today, and I will see you next week.
Right now at the Home Depot, you'll save up to 35% off appliance special buys, like a GE Appliances top load washer and dryer pair with deep clean and deep rinse options, a reliable heavy-duty agitator, and 4 precise water levels, just $4.78 each. Wash, dry, save, repeat. Today is the day for doing. With Spring Black Friday savings, now at the Home Depot. More saving, more doing. U.S. only while supplies last. See Astro Extra C-Store for details, valid through April 17th. Right now at the Home Depot, you'll save up to 35% off appliance special buys, like a GE Appliances top load washer and dryer pair with deep clean and deep rinse options, a reliable heavy-duty agitator, and 4 precise water levels, just $4.78 each. Wash, dry, save, repeat. Today is the day for doing. With Spring Black Friday savings, now at the Home Depot. More saving, more doing. U.S. only while supplies last. See Astro Extra C-Store for details, valid through April 17th.